Our Bible readings are consecutive, and as you join us for chapel several times each week, you'll find that we read through great slabs of the scriptures, and over your time here, I trust that you'll enjoy that and profit from it greatly. Every now and again, there's a creative preacher who chooses to preach on the passage that's been read, and that's good and responsible, but most of the time, they're like me. And I want to read you 1 Samuel chapter 8. It happened when Samuel was old that he set his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel. The name of his second, Abijah, judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his way, and they were bent on unjust gain, and they took a bribe, and they twisted justice. And all the elders of Israel gathered and came to Samuel, to Ramah, and they said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now set for us a king to judge us, like all the nations." And the thing was evil in the eyes of Samuel when they said, "Give for us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people, all that they say to you. For it is not you they have rejected, but it is me they have rejected from reigning over them. Like all the deeds they have done from the day I brought them up from Egypt and until this day, they forsook me and they served other gods. Thus they are doing also to you. But now, heed their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and declare to them the justice of the king who will reign over them." And Samuel said all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. And he said, "This will be the justice of the king who will reign over you. Your sons he will take, and he will set them for himself in his chariots and as his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. And he will set for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of 50, and some to do his ploughing and some to do his harvesting, and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. And your daughters he will take, for perfumers and for cooks and for bakers. And your fields and your vineyards and your olive orchards, the best, he will take, and he will give them to his servants. And your grain and your vineyards he will tithe, and he will give to his eunuchs and his servants. And your men servants and your maid servants, and of your young men, the best. And your donkeys he will take and put them to his work. Your flocks he will tithe, and you shall be for him slaves. And you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to heed the voice of Samuel. And they said, "No, but a king will reign over us, and even we will be like all the nations. And our king will judge us and will go out before us, and he will fight our battles." And Samuel heard all the words of the people. and he spoke them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make for them a king. Samuel then said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. Friends, it's terrific to welcome you all to this new college year, the year of 2005, and it is particularly, of course, terrific to welcome new members to our fellowship. I hope that the summer has been refreshing for all of us, and that this new year will be one in which you know more and more the goodness of God. Over the last couple of years, in chapel sermons in first term, I've been following the early chapters of Matthew's Gospel. No one will remember that, but I have been. And I had intentions of doing the same thing this year, but I've decided, for reasons with which I will not bore you, to continue on with 1 Samuel. And again, not many will remember, but we were doing that last year, if you were here. From the point we reached at the end of last year, those of you who were not here last year will pick up the threads easily enough, I think. And I'm gratified to find, I think, as you so often find when you turn to any part of the Bible, that here is a word that we do need to hear in this place and at this point of time. 1 Samuel 8 records a momentous occasion in the history of the nation Israel. Quite rightly, when we think of the history of this people, we think of great events, we think of the day when God spoke his promise to Abraham, when it all began. We think of the time when God redeemed this people out of slavery in Egypt under Moses. We think of the extraordinary days under Joshua when the land was given to them as promised. And we think of the great kingdom of David and then his son Solomon. And we think of the collapse of it all and how in the year 722 BC and then later in 587 BC it all dissolved. And we think perhaps of the period of the Babylonian exile towards the end of the Old Testament. Very high among the significant events that should be added to that bare skeleton is this day. This day on which the elders of Israel asked for a king. And I am serious when I say that the word of God in 1 Samuel 8 is just right for us today. Yes, I know that's true, and it could be said of any part of the Bible at any time and any place. I believe that, at least theoretically. But how is it so with 1 Samuel 8 and us today? Let's see. The chapter takes us forward some considerable time after the end of chapter 7 to the days of Samuel's old age. And the time when the old man, Samuel, did something very strange indeed. You see, Samuel was old, verse 1, and he set his sons as judges for Israel. The names are given to us, Joel and Abijah. We're told that they were judges in Beersheba. And then we are told that his sons did not walk in his way. They were bent on unjust gain. They took a bribe and they twisted justice. That's an attempt to capture the fact that bent and twisted are the same verb, but let's not worry about that. Chapter 7 concluded with a description of Israel enjoying the leadership of Samuel. They were remarkable days that we read of at the end of chapter 7. He judged Israel all the days of his life, chapter 7, verse 15. And we're aware that this role of judging that Samuel was engaged in involved, if we can put it like this, putting things right in Israel. Whether that meant defeating the enemies, as it certainly did earlier in chapter 7, or sorting out injustices in the community, as we seem to see at the end of chapter 7, Samuel was the judge who brought justice to Israel in this sense of putting things right in Israel and for Israel. The judge, the shofet, brought justice, mishpat, which in Samuel's case included security for the people, peace, and in all probability, some degree of prosperity. But now there is a problem. Samuel the judge Samuel, the leader that Israel had been given, Samuel, the one who had brought this justice in this sense to Israel, is old. And in at least this respect, he now immediately reminds us of his predecessor, old Eli, who had judged Israel for 40 years. Through the first four chapters of 1 Samuel, Eli has been the old man. Back in chapter 2, verse 22, we heard that Eli was very old. In chapter 3, verse 2, we were told that Eli's eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see. In chapter 4, verse 15, Eli was 98 years old. And when he died, in chapter 4, verse 18, we're reminded again that he was an old man. Growing old has its pros and cons, so I'm told. But on the con side, so I'm told, is decreasing energy and increasing physical weakness. And of course, there is the growing certainty that death is close. Israel's brief period of peace and security and a measure of prosperity under Samuel was all very well, but it was put in jeopardy by this simple, predictable fact: Samuel grew old. For reasons known only to himself, old Samuel decided to try an experiment. It was a very strange thing to do. You see, leadership in Israel had never been hereditary, except in the case of priests. In particular, and quite emphatically, judgeship was not hereditary. The story of Gideon in Judges chapter 8 is the classic case. Gideon rightly refused to make his son a ruler over Israel. Indeed, never before had a leader in Israel appointed his sons to take over the reins. So why did Samuel try to introduce this novelty? It's very hard to know, especially when we remember what happened with old Eli's sons. And again, the two sons doing their father's job with their names given to us remind us here of Hophni and Phinehas immediately. In some ways, Eli had done a reasonable job as priest. Remember how he brought the word of God, the word of God's promise to Hannah in chapter 1? And he understood that the Lord was calling young Samuel in chapter 3. But all of that, and whatever good things you might say about Eli, it was no guarantee that his sons would be any good. And in fact, of course, it was on the contrary. They were, as chapter 2 recounts, worthless men, sons of Belial. They did not know the Lord. They used their position for their own gain. They abused the people they were meant to serve. And they treated the offering of the Lord with utter contempt. So why did Samuel think it would be a good idea to have his sons take his place in the light of recent experience? That question remains one of the Bible's little unexplained mysteries. What we are told very clearly, however, is that whatever his reasons might have been, it was a big mistake. Samuel's sons turn out to be just like Hophni and Phinehas. They were corrupt. They were dishonest. They were immoral. They were perverters of justice. They were young men who used their positions for their own advantage, just like Eli's sons in chapter 2. So what is to be done? Where would the people of Israel find security and peace and prosperity, justice, now that Samuel was getting old and his sons were no hopers? Who would judge Israel now? Listen to the stunning proposal. Verse 4, all the elders of Israel gathered and came to Samuel to Ramah, and they said to him, behold, you are old. Opening line. And your sons do not walk in your ways. Now, set for us a king to judge us, like all the nations. Give us a king. I'm calling it a stunning proposal. From one point of view, the point of view of the elders of Israel, obviously, it was a reasonable proposal. Their assessment of the situation is obviously correct. Samuel is old. His sons are not exactly chips off the old block. We know that. We've just been told that. They've observed correctly. But a king, you see, a king could establish Israel. A king could build a stable political structure. A king could organize this nation into a real nation. There would be a stable political center of authority. There would be a unity to the nation. If only we had a king, a king would give us a visible, tangible expression of our unity, would bring us together. Our king would make us strong. A king would give us dignity. A king would be predictable. A king would give us reliable. After all, they might have said, this is the Iron Age. For goodness sake, we're not still living in the Stone Age or the Bronze Age. All the other nations by this stage had kings, and you could see what they'd done for them. They had become efficient and prosperous, strong and secure, while the Israelites, for goodness sake, the Israelites were still disorganized and unstable. They simply lurched from one crisis to the next. Give us a king. Give us a king to judge us, like all the nations. And again, of course, to judge us means to bring us justice in the broad sense of putting things right for us. Now, I don't think we understand this chapter until we sense the reasonableness of the proposal from the point of view of the elders of Israel. It was a sensible organizational model. It had a proven track record in the nations around them. So it certainly must have seemed. I cannot help thinking here of some proposals that come forward today to get the church strong and effective. The proven experience of management, the principles that make other organisations efficient and effective and strong and growing. I mean, can't we learn from IBM how to run an organisation well? Can't McDonald's teach us how to expand and grow? Well, they can do that. give us leaders like the effective organisations around us. If only we had structures and strategies and plans that learnt from those organisations, then the church could have an impact. With strategic planning, the church could expand its market share. I wonder whether you can hear an echo of the elders of Israel. Give us a king like all the nations. I won't dwell on the point now, but the sentiment expressed in 1 Samuel chapter 8 verse 5 I don't believe is entirely strange to us. Whenever we hear that this organizational structure or that planning model or whatever it might be is the key to securing and advancing the people of God, there can be a powerful reasonableness about the proposal. But is it the same kind of reasonableness of the elders' proposal in 1 Samuel 8? A king like the nations. Well, however reasonable it may have seemed, it should be obvious to us readers of the book that the proposal is breathtaking for its stupidity. That's what I meant by calling it stunning. The course of events in 1 Samuel chapters 1 to 7 makes it stunning. But even if you weren't here last year or can't remember any of it, verses 1 to 3, which I hope you can remember, of this chapter, make it astonishing. Hear the splendid logic of the elders of Israel. You see it there in verse 5. You are old, Samuel, and your sons do not walk in your way, so set up for us a form of leadership where sons succeed fathers. You see, that's what they were saying. The essence of kingship, the big difference between a king and all forms of leadership that Israel had ever known, was the hereditary element. In theory, that's what made kingship stable and predictable. It removed the uncertainty that came with the death of a leader. The eldest son simply took over. That was the big attraction of this institution. But what has their recent experience just demonstrated? In fact, twice over. That the best of leaders can have the worst of sons. And so the logical absurdity of verse 5 is stunning. Your sons do not walk in your ways, so give us a king to judge us. But it was more than that. It is hardly surprising that Samuel was none too happy with the proposal. He saw it as a vote of no confidence in his own leadership, no doubt. And hence verse 6, the thing was evil in the eyes of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. But the Lord has a way of taking everyone by surprise. And verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people, all that they say to you. For it's not you they have rejected, but it is me they have rejected from reigning over them. Like all the deeds they have done from the day I brought them up from Egypt until this day, they forsook me and they served other gods, thus they are doing also to you. But now heed their voice, or if you like, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and declare to them the justice of the king who will reign over them. You see, apart from the stupidity of the elders' logic, what was wrong with their proposal? Listen, Samuel, listen to everything that they are saying, and you will see the utter unfaithfulness of it. This is much more than a vote of no confidence in you, Samuel. You see, we as readers, we think back to chapter 7, where there was that massive trouncing of the Philistines. We can think back to chapters 4 through to 6 and the astonishing way in which Israel's enemies were brought to their knees. And if we can think back, we can ask the question, where have the people of Israel ever found peace and security? Where has it come from? And the answer is, from God. Without a king, Israel could be secure. The God of Israel was perfectly capable of looking after his people. That has been the clear lesson of chapters 1 to 7. Political, organizational, institutional structures cannot secure the people of God. Listen to the people as they say, give us a king like all the nations, like the Goyim, like the pagans, like the Gentiles, and you want to say, oh, like the Philistines, you mean. That really would be very clever. The extraordinary reality, of course, is that the Lord God was Israel's king. This proposal to find security in having a king like all the nations amounts to a rejection of God as their king, and indeed a rejection of his call to them to be his people, a holy nation, a priestly kingdom. Just look at the monarchies of the nations. Do they call on their people to return to the living God, like Samuel did in chapter 7? Do they pray for their people to the living God, like Samuel did? No? Then what kind of security and peace do they deliver, these kings, like the other nations have? Indeed, I want to ask the management consultants, and I immediately say some of my best friends are management consultants, but the strategic experts who know how we ought to organise things, and that is the way forward, who know very well how churches should be led and organised if they are going to make an impact, if they're going to be what they ought to be, do you find in the businesses where your proposals are implemented that godliness grows, and prayerfulness, and humility, and love, and peace, and patience, and kindness, and goodness. No? Then what kind of effectiveness are you offering us? Well, the most puzzling thing in this chapter is that the Lord nonetheless tells Samuel to heed the voice of the elders, although he must first solemnly warn them and declare to them the justice, just what kind of justice a king like the nations will bring them. And that's what Samuel does in verses 10 through to 18, which I won't read through again for you, but you noticed the refrain that ran through those verses, didn't you? Verse 11, your sons he will take. Verse 13, your daughters he will take. Verse 14, your fields, your vineyards, your olive orchards he will take. Verse 15, your grain and your vineyards he will tithe and give to his eunuchs and his servants. Verse 16, he will take. And climactically in verse 17, you shall be for him slaves, just like in Egypt. And verse 18, and you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. Wonderful description, underlining the point, your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. It will no longer be like in chapter 7. In verse 9, where Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. But it won't be like that anymore. Well, very quickly we come to the end of the chapter. The people are determined to begin their experiment. They make their demand in verses 19 to 20. They wouldn't listen to Samuel. They said, no, but a king will be over us, and even we will be like all the nations. And our king will judge us, and he will go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he spoke them in the ears of the Lord. And what was the Lord's reply? Verse 22, the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make for them a king. I'm not sure that Samuel was yet prepared to accept this idea, for the chapter concludes, Samuel then said to the men of Israel, go home. Now that's where we must leave the account for the moment, with many questions in the air, and we'll return to it, I think, on Friday this week, maybe. But as we leave it, I want to look back at the episode from another vantage point, from another day, many, many years later. On the day I have in mind, a man stood before the great pagan political power of that day, the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. And the question was put to this man, are you the king of the Jews? His reply was, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. Do you see what he was saying? I am not a king like all the other nations. The Christian message, the gospel of the New Testament, is that there is a king worth having. But he's a king whose kingship is altogether different from the kings of the nations. And to want a leader like the leaders of this world is faithless and foolish. Indeed, the message of this gospel is that there is a king whose justice is altogether different from the justice Samuel warned the people they would get from their king, whom they chose for themselves. For Jesus is a king who does not take and take and take. He is a king who gives and gives and gives. Just listen to this from a passage from Romans chapter 3 in a translation that I think resonates with what we've been seeing in 1 Samuel chapter 8. The justice of God has been manifested. The justice of God through the faithfulness of King Jesus to all who believe. There's no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. They are justified, this is God's justice, by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in King Jesus. This was to show God's justice, and it was to show his justice at the present time so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. There is a king to judge us. There is a king who brings a very different security, a very different peace, a very different justice. We'll have reason to think about this king again as we read on in the pages of 1 Samuel. But for the moment, just see the contrast between him and the king demanded in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And therefore, perhaps, the leadership we are all inclined to be attracted to.